Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest in You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
And from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange. As he signed a new Medicaid expansion law recently, Governor Chris Sununu said it was perhaps the biggest single piece of landmark legislation he's been involved in as governor. Sununu's signature means that more than 40,000 low-income Granite Staters will continue to get publicly funded health insurance. The program is a central piece of the Affordable Care Act and one that's persisted despite recent changes to other parts of the law. Today in The Exchange, we find out what's new, what could be on the way, and possible impacts on New Hampshire. Later in the hour, we conclude our Race for the First series with candidates for the first congressional district. As always, let's hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And as we look at changes to the Affordable Care Act, we have two guests. Julie Rovner joins us from D.C., where she's chief Washington correspondent with Kaiser Health News, host of the podcast What the Health. Julie, welcome back. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
With me in studio, Alex Feldwebel, deputy commissioner with the New Hampshire Insurance Department. And Alex, welcome back.
Thank you, Laura.
Well, Julie, before we get into the many changes and controversies with this law, if you could just step back for us, please. How did the Affordable Care Act try to extend coverage to new groups of Americans who weren't covered before?
Well, there were a number of ways, some of which have been rolled back, at least somewhat, which we'll talk about. But one of the main ways was creating a more stable individual insurance market. That's where people who don't have access to government health insurance or employer health insurance go and buy their own coverage. And the Affordable Care Act created new marketplaces, new types of health plans where insurers could not discriminate against people who had pre-existing conditions, for example, or charge women more, or charge people with pre-existing conditions more. And to help even further, there are these government subsidies that go up to 400% of poverty to help people afford their plan, since obviously they don't have an employer paying part of the cost. The other big piece of coverage expansion in the Affordable Care Act was expanding Medicaid to people with low incomes up to 133% of poverty line. That previously, Medicaid was only available to people who were both low income and met some other qualification. They were either pregnant women or children, or had a disability or were elderly. So this would just say, if you were low income, you can get Medicaid. In 2012, the Supreme Court ruled that should be voluntary for the states, not mandatory. So now we have the situation where most of the states, but not all of them, have expanded Medicaid.
Yeah, and New Hampshire has gone around and around on this, and we'll probably talk about that a little bit later. But right now, the governor did sign just recently a Medicaid expansion law here. So at this point, Julie, roughly how many states have Medicaid expansion? How many do not?
I think with New Hampshire, we're down to 18 that don't. Obviously, there's some odd situations. Maine voters voted last year fairly overwhelmingly to expand Medicaid. The governor has refused to implement it, and I forget whether that's being counted as a yes or a no. But it's roughly 32 states that have now expanded Medicaid and 18 that haven't.
So, Alex, just broadly, with these two pieces especially that Julie mentions, the healthcare exchanges where people can get help buying private insurance and this Medicaid expansion, overall, how has the Affordable Care Act affected the number of people uninsured here in New Hampshire?
Pretty significantly. With the Medicaid expansion, about 40,000 plus people gained coverage. And through the exchange, approximately another 40,000 did. So the rate of uninsurance went from 10.7% in 2013 to 5.9% in 2016. So that's a pretty significant improvement.
So from almost 11% to almost about 6%. So that's a pretty big drop. So, and about half and half, Alex, then 40,000 low-income Granite Staters getting coverage on a Medicaid expansion and 40,000 getting coverage on these healthcare exchanges.
Right.
And these, again, are the private marketplaces where private insurers say, yeah, we'll offer coverage, and the government will probably give you a subsidy to help pay for that coverage.
That's right. All but about 25% of the people getting coverage through the individual market are getting a subsidy, anyone under 400%. So that's made a big difference for people to be in a position to get coverage and keep it.
And one of the big issues nationally, and I'm going to ask Julie about this, but I'd like to go to you first, Alex, is insurers and how much they're willing to play ball on these exchanges. And we've seen a lot of volatility in recent years. How many private companies right now are offering so-called Obamacare plans on the exchanges?
There are three.
Three.
Harvard, Anthem, Blue Cross Blue Shield, and Ambetter. And it's been that way this year, and those three carriers are also registered as intending to offer coverage next year.
And Julie, I remember doing a program on this, I think last year, and you were probably on. There was a lot of sort of alarming headlines about some counties that only had one carrier that was willing to offer coverage on the exchanges. Maybe there were some counties that had none. Fill us in on how much private companies have been playing ball recently with these Obamacare exchanges.
Well, interestingly, and we're not through this whole sort of filing season yet where companies have to decide whether they're in or out. But what we've seen nationally is that companies are coming back to this market. There was so much uncertainty last year that many companies dropped out. It was not clear if the law was even going to be here for this year, which it still is. And one of the things that they did was they raised premiums. The companies that stayed raised premiums dramatically to protect themselves from things that did happen. There were, you know, reductions in outreach and people helping people sign up, which that was thought to deter healthier people from signing up. Congress got rid of the penalty for not having insurance, all these things that would tend to give insurers a sicker market of people. So they ended up raising their rate so high that now they're making money. They were losing money before. Now that they're making money, they're kind of happy to be in the market. And so we're seeing in many states, not all, it tends to vary by geography, but many states insurers are coming back. And of course, what's ending up happening is it is costing the taxpayers more. As we've talked about, the people who get subsidies are only required to pay a certain percentage of their income. So no matter how much the premiums go up, they don't have to pay anymore. They have to pay that set percentage and no more. So what happens? The federal government ends up paying the extra. Now, the people who are really getting hurt are the people who buy their own insurance and don't get subsidies. They're having to pay these dramatic increases. So it's a double-edged sword. Insurance is basically more widely available, but if you're not getting government help, it's going to also be way more expensive.
Go ahead, Alex.
And we're seeing that in New Hampshire just this last year, going from 2017 to 2018, prices went up a lot. On average, there was a 52% increase in the individual market. And for people with subsidies, that basically didn't affect them because their subsidies went up correspondingly. But for that group up above 400% of poverty, we have a real concern about them because we're seeing some of them drop off because of the large increases in premiums.
Just deciding not to buy health insurance.
We don't know where they're going. We're looking into that. We're trying to figure out where they're landing.
And we've heard from a lot of those folks over the years who've said, I bought coverage in the early years on the Obamacare exchanges. It wasn't too bad. Then I saw these huge price spikes. I make just enough money to not qualify for that federal subsidy, Alex. And so, you know, what do I do?
Right. Right.
So, Julie, the 75% of people that Alex described here in New Hampshire who do get the subsidies on these Affordable Care Act exchanges, as you guys have both said, they didn't feel the pinch, but the taxpayers did because ultimately it's tax dollars that pay those subsidies. Some critics of the Affordable Care Act have called those subsidies a bailout for insurance companies because it allows them to jack up prices while most customers don't feel the pain. So what's the status now of those subsidies? I know there's been some debate in Washington.
Well, the subsidies that were called the insurance bailout were these subsidies. They're called cost-sharing reductions, and there's an extra subsidy for people who earn less than 250% of poverty. Everybody else just gets help with their premiums, but those people in that lower category get help not just paying their premiums, but because they have lower incomes, get help paying their deductibles and other out-of-pocket costs. And those subsidies are required in the law that the insurers have to provide them to these customers. What happened was last October, President Trump canceled the federal payment, basically the reimbursement to the insurance companies of that money. There had been a very arcane lawsuit in the House that never quite got resolved, but where it was left was that Trump was able to just stop paying this. There was bipartisan support for reinstating them last fall, but what ended up happening is insurers sort of found a way around it. They raised premiums and ended up getting the federal government to pay what they would have paid through a different spigot.
Wow.
But as you mentioned, what really happened are that many of the people who didn't get subsidies ended up paying higher premiums. In some states, they were also somewhat shielded, but by this spring, when Congress was thinking about putting those subsidies back, it would have meant an increase in premiums for some people. It would have disrupted the market even more to put them back. There are some other possibilities that Congress is looking at, but it's so hard to get bipartisan support for anything that has, you know, the words Affordable Care Act in it.
Well, today in the exchange, the ins and outs of the Affordable Care Act, both nationally and here in New Hampshire. Julie Rovner joins us from D.C., Chief Washington Correspondent with Kaiser Health News. In studio is Alex Feldwebel, Deputy Commissioner with New Hampshire's Insurance Department. And let's hear from you, your questions and comments about some of the changes or debates over this law that we've been hearing about recently. 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. One more time, our number, 1-800-892-6477. And Julie, a broad question for you, and Alex, you too. How has, Julie, the Affordable Care Act and all these changes that you guys are talking about affected those many Americans who aren't covered by it? In fact, from what I understand, Julie, most people aren't covered by the Affordable Care Act.
That's right. The individual insurance market, which is a big chunk of what the Affordable Care Act did, is about roughly 18 million people, you know, out of 330 million Americans. Most people still get their insurance from an employer, or they get it from a government program, from Medicare or Medicaid. Obviously, as we discussed, there were some big Medicaid changes with the Affordable Care Act. There were some significant Medicare changes, including things like closing the notorious donut hole in Part D drug coverage. That was in the Affordable Care Act. There were some rules about employer coverage and what employer coverage, some benefits that employer coverage has to cover, and some more extra protections for people. So sort of around the margins, almost everybody is affected in some way by the Affordable Care Act. But in the big ways, it's a fairly small number of people.
What about New Hampshire, Alex? Same question for you.
Yeah, it's been true as well. The employer-based markets have been relatively stable compared to the individual market as it has had to react to these changes at the federal level. At the Insurance Department, we reach out to employers and try to determine what their needs are. And the large group market's doing pretty well, pretty stable. The small employers, their struggles mainly with affordability overall as healthcare costs keep going up and utilization, the premiums are becoming harder and harder to afford. But overall, I'd say the employer-based market, the source of coverage, has been fairly stable.
So the Affordable Care Act's sort of ups and downs and woes haven't really affected private insurance here in New Hampshire, again, which is what most people are covered by in the Grand State?
You mean employer-based coverage?
Right.
It has affected it less. It's been relatively stable.
Again, our number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Today in the Exchange, we're looking at some of the changes and debates around the Affordable Care Act, and we'd love to hear from you. And let's go to the phones, both of you. Jessica's calling from Dover. Hi, Jessica. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you.
Sure. Go ahead.
I think we need to look at the big picture in ways that which the Affordable Care Act sort of failed, that the Democrats failed to include a public option initially. And I think that would make a big difference for many people. If we had a public option on the exchange, such as signing up for Medicare for all ages, we wouldn't need Medicaid expansion because everyone would be eligible.
Well,
and in the big picture of things in this country, we have the private insurance companies given the luxury of insuring basically the healthy working population, and we leave the disabled, the indigent, and the elderly, the ones who actually have, you know, the higher health care costs, to the expense of the taxpayer.
Jessica, it's good to hear from you. Yeah, I'm going to just jump in for a second because I do want to ask Julie Rovner about this. So I'm glad you called, Jessica. The public option, now, this is sort of a blast from the past, but just remind us, Julie, what that was. It was heartily discussed at the time the Affordable Care Act was being debated.
It was not only hardly discussed, it passed the House. It almost passed the Senate, but they could not get those last couple of votes. Rather famously, Joe Lieberman of Connecticut would not vote for it, which was the idea to have a public option, possibly Medicare, possibly something else that people could buy into instead of buying private insurance. Now, I would say that if you'd had a public option, that wouldn't obviate the need for Medicaid. There are 9 million people who are on both Medicare and Medicaid. I think a lot of people don't realize until they get there that Medicare doesn't cover a whole lot of costs. Most people on Medicare either have some their own private supplemental insurance, or they have supplemental insurance provided by an employer, or if they're low income, they have supplemental insurance provided by Medicaid. So Medicare requires some pretty significant cost sharing on the part of the patient. But I think the argument for the public option is that it would help hold down prices from the insurers, from the private insurers who would, because they would want to compete with that public option. There's also the possibility that the public option would draw people with more significant health problems, and that would leave healthier people for the private insurers, who could then lower their premiums accordingly because they would have, they wouldn't be trying to cover as many sick people.
Oh, that's interesting. Go ahead, Alex.
Well, in response to Jessica's interest in the big picture, part of the big picture is we would step back and look at why insurance premiums have been going up across the country. The insurance department has an annual hearing and report that we produce on health insurance cost drivers. And between 82 and 90% of every premium dollar goes to the cost of health care. And as I think a lot of us know now, health insurance costs and utilization have been increasing steadily, and that's really what's been driving the need for a solution. And it seems that a big picture also has to address how we control healthcare costs.
Yeah, so don't just focus on the insurance and the premiums and the rates. Focus on what's driving those.
Right.
Premiums and rates, although a couple times you guys have used the word utilization. So, Alex, utilization in one sense is a good thing, right? It means people are going to the doctor when they need to.
Yeah, but researchers at Dartmouth have, Elliot Fisher, for example, have estimated that 30% of all health care is not needed. And by
30%, that's a lot.
Yes. It's quite a lot. And if we change the way we pay for health care to provide an incentive for cost-effective care and a disincentive for ineffective care, we can make a lot of progress in making coverage affordable. So that's the big picture. That's the hard nut to crack.
Well, and that gets into a topic that, you know, we've done entire shows on and probably
yes.
should again, which is, you know, what is that 30%? Who's responsible for it? Is it right. doctors promoting certain tests? Is it patients going when maybe they don't need to or not understanding? Is it
right.
management of chronic illnesses? So, wow, that's a big one. Yeah. We will talk more about the Affordable Care Act changes, debates around this law. Lots of changes could be coming up in the fall, so we'll find out more. You can join us like Jessica did. The number, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And a quick reminder, a little bit later in our hour, we conclude our Race for the First series on the 1st Congressional District with Democratic Congressional candidate Paul Cardinal. All that's coming up, so stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
I love all parts of NHPR.
As an NHPR underwriter, you can connect to a news service that is personally important to people across New Hampshire.
Something that connects me to my community, to my state, and it's an important part of my daily life.
And NHPR listeners support businesses that support their station.
We feel that NHPR is sort of part of our family. It's just part of our community.
To learn more about how to speak to NHPR's loyal, community-minded audience, go to nhpr.org/underwrite.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, we're looking at the Affordable Care Act under the Trump administration and some of the changes that could be coming this fall that have already happened and their impact possibly here in New Hampshire. Join us, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter. It's NHPR Exchange. Again, the email is exchange@nhpr.org. With me in studio, Alex Feldwebel, Deputy Commissioner with the New Hampshire Insurance Department. And joining us from D.C., Julie Rovner, Chief Washington Correspondent with Kaiser Health News and host of the podcast, What the Health. And a couple other changes that I wanted to ask both of you about. And Julie, to you first, New Hampshire's two Democratic senators held an event in the state recently highlighting what they called the administration's sabotage of this law. Those are their words. What have been the main concerns of Democrats in Congress when it comes to this law? What's that sabotage that the senators are referring to?
Well, the administration from the very beginning has said their goal is to make the law not work. In fact, President Trump goes around and often says that the law is already gone, which it is not. But that is one of the things that the Democrats say is sabotage, is basically talking it down. They have created, and we're actually expecting another regulation literally any minute, sort of escape valves for people who want to buy cheaper insurance. But that cheaper insurance might not cover things that people would need. So it's not clear how popular that's going to be. The Justice Department a month or two ago said that it wasn't going to defend a lawsuit filed by Republican attorneys general against the law, arguing that getting rid of the penalty for not having insurance basically renders the entire law unconstitutional. And the administration says, well, we don't think that's the case, but we do think that maybe getting rid of the requirement to have insurance, they should invalidate the pre-existing condition protections. The administration has cut funding, as I mentioned earlier, for outreach and people who help people, other people sign up by almost 90% over 2 years. Just a couple of weeks ago, they cut payments to insurers that are supposed to go between insurers to sort of balance out who gets sick people and who gets healthy people. That was a result of a lawsuit from February, and then they just as suddenly started those payments again. So basically, they're creating a lot of uncertainty for this law and how it's going to play out. And most analysts say that that uncertainty is adding to premium increases for next year, that insurers who are just not sure, you know, who they're going to get, who they're going to have to cover, how much they're going to have to pay, are increasing their premiums accordingly.
Well, and a couple things I'd love to follow up on there with you, Julie, and fold Alex in as well. So there are these association health plans or short-term plans. These are plans that the president and others have promoted as a way to lower costs. You know, critics of the Affordable Care Act call it the unaffordable Affordable Care Act because prices for some folks have gone up so much. So what's an association health plan, Julie?
Well, an association health plan allows basically groups of small businesses to band together to negotiate for a better rate. That's the idea behind them. They have existed in the past. Many of them were sort of plagued by financial problems. Often there was just not enough. You know, these are not insurance companies. They don't have to have, you know, tremendous reserves. And sometimes they've gone broke or sometimes they've been scams. The idea, and I think part of what we ended up with the association health plan rule was that they did try to put some protections in, and they put so many protections in that now it's not clear that anybody's going to bother to actually put them together. The president said last week that, you know, they were doing great and, you know, people were signing up in droves. Well, you can't actually sign up for these until September, so they don't exist yet. We're expecting the rule on short-term plans, possibly as soon as today, probably this week sometime, so we haven't seen sort of the final rule on that. These were plans that people buy basically to tide them over if between jobs, or, you know, if you lose your, if you're a student, you're graduating, you just need something for a couple of months. But what the administration is proposing to do is essentially make these plans available for 364 days of the year. These types of plans can medically underwrite, which means if you have a pre-existing condition, they can charge you more. They frequently don't cover things like maternity care or prescription drugs. They tend to be, you know, much, much, much less comprehensive. Sure, they're cheaper, but that's because they don't have as many benefits.
Well, and this raises an issue, Julie, that people have complained about. And we've gotten calls from people who said, look, I don't want gold-plated health insurance. You know, I'm an older man. I don't need maternity care. I have no problems with substance abuse. I don't need substance abuse coverage. So these association plans seem to be trying to address the market needs of people who don't want full-blown coverage and thereby reducing costs.
Yeah, that's more the short-term plans that have that have that many fewer benefits. The association health plans can have fewer benefits, but not as many fewer benefits as the short-term plans.
I see.
And yes, that is true. But, you know, people say, I mean, obviously, you know, men are not going to get pregnant and women are not going to get prostate cancer. But in general, the idea of insurance is to spread the costs of healthcare widely across, excuse me, everyone. If only women, you know, could buy, you know, if only women of childbearing age bought maternity insurance, it would be unaffordable. But if you spread it over across everyone, it is a social good for women to have babies. It's something that the population needs to continue. You know, the question is, should that cost be borne entirely by the woman? And obviously, it is very expensive to have a baby these days. So there, you know, this is a broader societal debate that we thought we had during the debate over the Affordable Care Act, but apparently not.
I see. So it's sort of a broader philosophical debate versus this sort of, you know, consumer-oriented, I do want this, I don't want that, a more cafeteria-style approach. Alex, I can see you want to jump in on either association health plans or these short-term plans. Again, yeah, different plans that don't have as many requirements as the Affordable Care Act plans.
Right. We're facing this at the state level. The insurance department is looking at this closely. From a very practical perspective, we know we have this group in the individual market above 400% of poverty who has experienced severe rate increases and they're looking for alternatives. We know our small employer market is shrinking, primarily in response to the increasing premiums. So we know there's this group out there who are looking for alternatives.
Yeah, what's available for them?
So these short-term limited duration policies and the kind of coverage that might be available through association health plans, which is generally going to be less comprehensive coverage, might be a vehicle for providing these groups with an alternative that they can afford. The challenge is what Julie, you know, referred to, is that you can have this phenomenon where it's the healthier groups and individuals who gravitate toward the less comprehensive coverage, and then the sicker or older individuals or groups are left in the ACA-regulated market, causing premiums to go up
even more.
So we're looking at that issue as well and trying to figure out whether there are tools we can use to preserve the integrity of the risk pools.
All right. Very interesting. Let's go back to our listeners. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email with your questions or comments about some of the many changes to the Affordable Care Act that we're hearing about happening right now and coming down the pike in the fall. Let's go back to the phones, both of you. And Lucy's joining us. Hi, Lucy. Go ahead. You're in the air.
Hi. How are you?
Fine.
It's Lucy from Hopkinton, and I love the show. Love you're doing health policy. Alex, wondering exactly what you were talking about. What's the consequence of these new ideas of paring down the plans and paring down the benefits? so that you can cherry pick what benefits you want to suit you? What's the effect on the overall insurance market of that? And how do we manage that going forward? Do we end up back where we were in 2009? What are the solutions that might be available going forward with that kind of option? It both helps people to have narrow plans, but at the same time, it doesn't actually manage the ultimate risk.
Lucy, thank you so much. Great question. Go ahead, Alex.
Good morning, Lucy. Good to hear from you. Yeah, that's the important challenge that I mentioned a moment ago, just briefly, is that when you create these different markets right next to each other with easy mobility from one to the other, the ACA-regulated market versus association health plan market.
Which is less regulated.
And lighter benefits. You are predictably going to get this phenomenon where the healthy people go to the coverage that's less comprehensive, and you can end up generating an adverse selection spiral. That's the insurance word for prices going up in the more comprehensive market. And there are tools you can use to address that, and we're with the insurance department, we're working with the governor's office to think about those things, and I'm sure it's going to be a topic of debate in the legislature next session.
Well, thank you for the call, Lucy. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Julie, something you mentioned earlier too, pre-existing conditions. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, this seems to be sort of the one area where just about everybody says, no, insurers shouldn't be able to discriminate against you, deny you coverage if you have a pre-existing condition. So what's the status of that part of the Affordable Care Act?
Well, the status of that part of the Affordable Care Act is that it is still in effect, that if you are in an Affordable Care Act compliant plan, insurers not only can't deny you coverage for a pre-existing condition, they can't charge you more. Previously, they might say, well, we'll sell you insurance, but we're going to charge you four times more. That they can't do either of those things. They can't charge you more because you're a woman and you might have a baby. All of those things. And that, of course, has had the effect of increasing premiums for people who used to be less expensive because they would say, well, if you're, a 25-year-old man, we would charge you way less because you're less likely to use medical care. So there's been some frustration amongst people who are paying more to cover the people who are now paying more to help people who used to pay more and are now paying less. The issue and the reason that the Democrats are sort of hitting on it is partly because it's popular. There's a lot of people who have pre-existing conditions and they're worried about being able to get insurance if they need it. But also, as I mentioned, there's this lawsuit that hasn't really gone anywhere yet. It's in the very earliest stages where some Republican attorneys general are trying to invalidate the entire law, and the Justice Department, whose job it is to defend the law, said, yeah, we're going to defend the law, but we think that maybe the pre-existing condition protections might have to go away. And so the Democrats have pounced on that as saying that Republicans are now against coverage for pre-existing conditions.
So would these associated health plans, Julie, or these short-term health plans that you were talking about earlier, how would those address pre-existing conditions?
Well, the short-term plans can, as I said, medically underwrite, so they can go back and look and see if you've been sick, and they can, in fact. Well, we haven't seen the final rule yet, but the idea is that they would be able to either turn you down or charge you more for pre-existing conditions. That's less true for the association health plans, but the concern with the association health plans is as we mentioned earlier, they would tend to be more favorable for people who are healthier in general. They would take the healthy people out of the pool, leaving only the sick people in the Affordable Care Act pool, which would then require premiums to rise.
Well, and Alex, if Congress or the president did get rid of this pre-existing condition provision for insurers, what New Hampshire rules or regs might kick in, if any?
We would lapse back to the existing laws on the books in New Hampshire that address that. And it varies depending on whether you have employer-sponsored coverage or not. And we would also still have that federal law, HIPAA, that says if you have had insurance coverage and you're moving from one employer to another, you can continue without being subject to a pre-existing condition exclusion. So there would be some protections under HIPAA. There are some protections under state law that limit pre-existing condition exclusions to a 9-month period if you haven't had that prior coverage. So we would go back to an environment like that.
So that's interesting. So there are some state rules and regs that would kick in to protect right. folks who had a pre-existing condition. That's do other states do that, Alex, I wonder? Is that pretty common?
There are a number. I don't know how common it is. I think New Hampshire was in a minority of states, but that limited pre-existing conditions. But I would say maybe a third of states have on their books some kind of limitation on pre-existing condition exclusion periods.
Something else that you mentioned, Juliet, I wanted to ask you about, the individual mandate. From what I understand, the new Republican tax law doesn't actually repeal the individual mandate, but it reduces the penalty for going uncovered to zero. So kind of the same thing. What?
Not necessarily the same thing.
Okay. So clear me up there. Yeah.
Yeah. There are a lot of people who say the fact that there was an individual mandate has sort of changed behavior, and the idea that they've taken away the penalty but left the mandate on the books, that there may be some number of people, I don't know how large it would be, but who think, you know, it is technically still the law and it is the expressed will of Congress that this is some kind of a social good, that we should have insurance. There's now a presumption that you should have insurance, even if the penalty has been reduced to zero. Also, it's the reduction of the penalty to zero that's basically the part of this lawsuit that we're still, that may be some years in the resolution. But so, you know, the fact is they couldn't eliminate the entire mandate in the tax bill because of the rules that governed how they passed the tax bill. The only thing they could do was reduce it to zero. So that's what they did.
Oh, I see. Sure.
It wasn't on purpose. It's just the rules that allowed them to pass the tax bill with a simple majority in the Senate and not get it filibustered. That was the only kind of language they could use.
What was the economic philosophy, Julie, behind this individual mandate? It's something that people talked about in this country for a while.
That's right. And actually, you know, sort of ironically, in the 90s, when President Clinton was talking about his health plan, the Republican alternative was this individual mandate. They did it in Massachusetts. They passed it on a state basis in 2006 under then Governor Romney. This was, you know, and Governor, when he was running for president, Governor Romney was pretty enthusiastic about it, that there should not be free riders. That when you get, you know, hit by a bus and you get taken to the hospital, you get treated, whether or not you can pay for it, whether or not you have insurance. And the idea is that everybody should be part of that social responsibility. At some point, you're going to consume health care, and at some point, somebody's going to pay for it, and perhaps you should have insurance. And that was basically the origin of it. It was controversial from the start. It was controversial among Republicans when some of them supported it in the 1990s. It was way controversial when the Democrats supported it and put it in the Affordable Care Act. And it was controversial when it was upheld in the Supreme Court with the deciding vote of Chief Justice Roberts, who is still sort of an enemy to many Republicans to this day for just that single vote.
Well, and hard to believe I have to wrap it up with both of you. And Julie, I'll go to you first. It sounds like there's a lot going on, both in terms of Congress and the president and the individual states, and never mind what the courts are doing. So what are you looking at immediately, Julie? What are you going to be watching this week in terms of the Affordable Care Act?
Well, this week, I think we're waiting for the final rule on the short-term plans, which is sitting at the Office of Management and Budget and apparently ready to come out. And we're still watching rate filings. Each state has to report, you know, what insurers are asking for in terms of premium increases and in some cases decreases for next year. So we're sort of getting ready for, you know, calendar year 2019 insurance.
And how about you, Alex? What are you watching in your role as an insurance regulator?
Well, we're conferring closely with the carriers and frequently. Our attitude is that the tide is high, but we're holding on here. And we're looking carefully at the Association Health Plan and the short-term limited duration rule.
Okay. Well, Alex Feldwebel, Julie Robner, thank you so much, both of you. Really appreciate it.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
Well, coming up, we conclude our Race for the First series with the many candidates for New Hampshire's first congressional district. Our last interview will be with Democratic candidate Paul Cardner, and our conversation will be on Facebook Live, so you can listen and watch. If you'd like all that's coming up, stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.